morning and welcome to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Kimberly Cronick. Today is July 19th, our special day of broadcasting on local food. Nearly 80% of Illinois' total farmland is covered by total land is covered by farms. That's more than 76,000 farms and more than 28 million acres. Most of Illinois' farmland is devoted to corn and soybeans. These commodity crops provide the base for animal feed, ink, paint, clothing, wax, cosmetics, medicines, and ethanol. In fact, most of the corn grown in Illinois is used to produce ethanol, and Illinois farmers produce more ethanol than any other state. With so much farmland devoted to commodity crops, it's no wonder that 95% of the food we eat in Illinois comes from somewhere else. But there's increased interest among many sectors to create clusters of regional food businesses that sell Illinois-made produce and Illinois-raised livestock to the people who live here. Here to talk about such efforts in central Illinois are three guests. In the studio with me are farmer Dave Bishop of Prairie Earth Farm in Atlanta, Illinois. And joining me in a moment will be Tara Brockman, founder and executive director of the Land Connection in Bloomington, Illinois. And joining us by phone is Kenneth Meter, a food system analyst and president of Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis. I want to welcome you, Ken and Dave.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
It's good to be here.
Great. And I also want to welcome our listeners. Your questions and comments are invited. To join our live conversation this hour, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, Farmer Dave Bishop, I'm going to start with you. You own Prairie Earth Farm, a 300-acre organic farm in Atlanta, Illinois, which is in Logan County, and you've owned it for 30 years. What do you grow?
Well, we try to grow as many different crops as we can. We happen to believe that diversity is very key to any kind of sustainable farming operation. So we raise traditional crops like corn and soybeans, wheat, oats, and forages, and we also have a vegetable operation. We grow beef, pork, chicken, and eggs as well.
And for those of us who aren't farmers, give us a sense of the operational costs and the work involved in these commodity crops, corn and soybeans, versus vegetables.
Well, the advantage in commodity crops, of course, is the ability to mechanize. And you can cover a lot of ground a lot quicker than you can with a typical vegetable operation. So growing food, as we think of things that we eat on our table, is a lot more labor-intensive. It requires both more management and more labor than things like commodity crops, where you can mechanize the process.
And I want to talk with Ken here. Ken, you're the president of Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis. Tell us the mission of your organization.
Well, our mission is really to work with groups like the Edible Economy Project in Illinois and others around the country to really help bring some research, some analysis, some other tools that help the work of local food systems flourish around the country. And we've worked in 83 regions and 30 states in the last few years.
I want to talk a little bit about the studies. You have completed, like you said, more than 80 local farm and food economy studies in 30 states, including three right here in Illinois.
Yes.
In 2011, you completed a study with the Edible Economy Project, and Tara Brockman is going to be here and talking about that in a moment. And that study, which also involved Heartland Community College, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council, and others, you surveyed 32 counties in central Illinois. Tell us, what was the purpose of your study and what did you find?
Well, the purpose of the study was to look at the economy of food in central Illinois. So we had a chance to understand how is money flowing through the region when we trade food and what are some of the obstacles you're going to encounter if you try to build some of these clusters of food businesses you talk about. What's going to make that favorable to do? What's going to make that more difficult?
And what are some of the things you're finding that would make it favorable?
Well, I think what's favorable is that you have very rich topsoil and a lot of very experienced farmers who are there who are really in many ways well positioned to meet local needs. But of course, as you mentioned, most of those farms are really geared towards products that are going to be processed for some other use and often exported out of the region.
And Farmer Dave Bishop, what happens to the corn and soybeans on your organic farm? Where do they go?
Well, we usually feed quite a bit of that to our livestock. We do sell some to other farmers or grain mills in the area. But what we try to concentrate on is keeping our nutrients on the farm as much as possible, and by also value adding to the products that we grow. So normally you would try to produce all the feed that you're going to feed your own livestock and market those products in a value-added way.
And tell us about the vegetables that you grow. When did you start? I know you've been farming since 79. Mm-hmm. When did you start growing vegetables, and why did you add that to your what you grow on your land?
Well, it's sort of informally. We always had a garden, and the garden got bigger and bigger, and then you start to sell a few things, and eventually it's turned into a 20-acre enterprise. But over the years, you know, that's kind of a slowly evolving process. And also, over the past few years, you've seen a lot of increase in the interest of people in getting things fresh from the farm. And so as the interest grew, why the farm, the production grew to go along with it.
And are there other farmers that you know that are doing what you're doing, going from commodity crops to vegetable food to feed people in Illinois?
Most of the local food folks are probably new, young people getting into the business. The average conventional farmer in Illinois is 60-some years old. So not too many of those folks really want to transition or get into some new enterprise, which is, you know, a reasonable thing to do, I guess, when you're 60 years old. But some of them have expressed interest in that. Your mid-sized farm operation, maybe a 500 to 1,000-acre farm, is getting squeezed pretty hard by the larger farms and are looking to diversify. And so there's some interest in that. We're counting on those farmers to be a significant part of the scaling up process. So there is a lot of interest both among those particular farmers and among those of us who are trying to develop the infrastructure for local food systems.
And Ken, in your study of this 32 counties in Central Illinois, what are the possibilities for that infrastructure that might lead to economic growth for farmers and for consumers who want to eat food made in Illinois?
Well, I think I really like what Dave was talking about, the difficulties in changing. But there is a $4.3 billion market for food in Central Illinois. That's how much food local consumers spend. How much money people spend buying food. And unfortunately, it's almost $3.9 billion of that is leaving the region. So there's a tremendous amount of money in people's hands that is currently leaving. And if we can find ways to bring it back to the region, it'll build lots of wealth, I think, for local people. Some of the infrastructure that's required would be to have some places where when the crop is harvested, you have a place to store that, whether it's in a freezer or a cool room or a room temperature room or underground in a root cellar. But we can harvest lots of foods when they're ripe and store them for later use in the wintertime when we don't have crops coming off the land. We also need some local trucking companies to make it really efficient to transport food from local farms to local consumers. We need to have more knowledge bases that just help us understand how the food system is changing over time and how these business clusters are faring so that we can help in a policy way and in a coordination way to really make sure that that work goes as well as possible.
Well, I want to remind listeners that this is Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Kimberly Cronick. We're discussing efforts to increase the production of food in Illinois for consumption in Illinois, and we welcome your questions and comments. The number to call is 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're focusing on the farmer right now, and we have a farmer in the studio with us, Dave Bishop. Tell me a little bit about the vegetables that you grow, what it is that you grow, what can we grow in Illinois year-round? What could consumers expect to eat if we produced more food and we ate the food that was made right here in Illinois?
Well, a great number of the basic foods, the common things that we eat, tomatoes, potatoes, onions, the things you see on the table most of the time we're able to grow in Illinois. With the use of season-extending techniques like hoop houses, we're able to At our farm, for example, we can raise salad mix virtually every year or every month of the year except July and August. And so carrots, spinach, salad mix are all things that can be grown virtually year-round here. There's a lot of interest in expanding local food systems by increasing the capacity of the farm to produce year-round or use season-extending techniques. And that's really going to help deliver a more steady supply of basic food staples to people in central Illinois that come from this area.
And Ken, when you think about the counties in Illinois that you've looked at and the potential for creating these hubs, what excites you about what you see? You've looked at this across the country in many different states. Is there anything unique or special that you're excited about in terms of the potential here in Illinois?
Well, I think the most unique thing that I found was in the community of Normal, because they've already done some of this kind of planning with regards to transportation. They've formed a transportation hub around the development of a revised Amtrak station, and have put in a hotel and a parking ramp and a new city county office building, so that they really kind of cluster a lot of activity in one place. It'll make sure each one of those is more likely to survive. And I think that's the kind of thinking we need to do to build the food hub that Dave is talking about, where we have different parties of the transaction, from the farmer to the processor to the distributor, sitting down together and saying, how do we make a system that's going to work well for all of us and be as efficient as possible? And I think what I loved about talking with the officials in Normal was that you could see a real sense of, we know how to collaborate, we know how to sort of lay down our individual turf long enough to really think together and come up with some very searching plans for how we do this in the most effective way possible.
And Dave, do you have personal experience of what Ken's talking about, this willingness sort of to work together? What's going on in Bloomington?
Oh, very much so. The city council is very interested in the issue of sustainability generally, and local food system in particular. The Edible Economy Project and Heartland College has just received a rural enterprise grant for $99,000 to actually begin the process of getting these food hubs up and running. So there's a lot of energy behind this. There's a lot of people interested in this. There's a lot of excitement. And things are really starting to happen. And, of course, once things actually start to happen, and then the interest really builds quickly.
We're talking about efforts to build regional food hubs in central Illinois, and you're welcome to join the conversation by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-945. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILR, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So we have all this farmland in Illinois. 80% of the state is covered in farmland. How is it that it came to be that most of what we grow is commodity crops? A lot of that is exported. I'd like to help us understand how it came to be and what effort is involved if we're going to take some of that land or transform some of that land for these other means. Who wants to take that one?
I could start with that anyway. I think, you know, as I look at the history of farming in the Midwest on the Great Plains, I think one thing that's really sort of very notable is that the first pioneers who came out often came out with enough money to buy land, but also some debt to an Eastern banker to help them have the money to buy land. And so a lot of people came out. Most of their neighbors were farmers. Most of the local markets were small, and people had debts they had to pay, so they started thinking about, what can I grow that I can sell that'll make me money that I can pay my banker back with? And so you have a whole pattern in the Midwest of farmers focusing not on feeding the people nearby, but farming cities far away. And so the whole mentality became, how do we export food? How do we ship it far away? How do we think about paying off debts? And the whole planning process is saying, how do we build a local food system that really makes sure everyone eats well and everybody has good access to really high-quality food? That really has never happened before in Illinois. And I think this is a historical opportunity to really create the infrastructure from the ground up that really makes sure that everyone is doing a very good job of eating and getting access to local farms.
And also, after World War II, and when chemical fertilizers and pesticides and all these things became available, this permitted large-scale monocultural farming to work, in the sense that you could grow these crops. Before that, you really had to have diversity. You had to have that to keep the, maintain the fertility of your soil, to control pests, to control weeds. Farms had a diversity of livestock and grains and other things that made the system work. All right, naturally. All right, now you've got a situation where the system is made to work with the use of these artificial chemicals. When we think about sustainable farming, we're looking at how valuable that diversity was. That's what made the system work. It can make the system work again. So rather than to be dependent on these oil-based inputs into farming, the local food system and the idea of sustainable agriculture is to restore this system of diversity where you could, without those inputs, produce good quality food.
Let's talk a little bit about the cost. We talked about the cost of farming, the efficiency of row crops. Dave, you are an organic farmer in Atlanta. What did it take to become an organic farmer? What was the cost involved, and why did you decide to do that?
Well, we started out as a conventional. I guess I started out as a child on an organic farm because they were all that way. And then when I got back from college and began to farm on my own, this is really when pesticides and all these things were beginning to work well. They had kind of gotten them figured out. And so I started out conventionally using all these things, including the antibiotics and the livestock and all the steroids. And it became evident to me pretty quickly that there were some problems with these things. You fed antibiotics to livestock that didn't necessarily keep them healthy. It allowed you perhaps to put them in conditions where they were so crowded you couldn't live without it. But do you really want to do that? And it became an issue here of I don't think this system can work in the long term. And so we start to go back to what I remembered as a child, which is that we raised perfectly healthy animals without antibiotics because they were in natural conditions. And we raised good crops when we had a more involved rotation, when we raised hay and other things. And so we knew we could do these things, but we'd kind of lost the knowledge. Really, the ways of doing these has sort of died with the older people. So I had the advantage of having seen this as a child. I remembered some of it. And so we began to kind of backtrack, and we got rid of the antibiotics and the steroids and found we had perfectly wonderfully healthy animals without those kinds of things, if you changed the conditions they were growing in. And if you added more crops to your rotation, you could get weed suppression, you could get insect suppression, these chemical inputs could be replaced. And then the demand began to come around where people wanted them, and they were willing to pay for these things. And so that really kind of is how the local food system got started, just by the demand and the interest of people, and then farmers responding to that by saying, yeah, we can do it that way. And if you'll buy it, if there's economic incentive for us, we can make this work.
Ken, your study looked at the economic income of people in the 32 counties in central Illinois that you looked at, and you found that oh gosh, I think it's 28% are below the poverty level.
Yes.
How, and Americans in general spend less percentages of their income on food than people in the other parts of the world, but how will people who live in the region who are poor, for example, be able to afford local food when, for example, take broccoli. I can get organic broccoli at my local supermarket. It's about $2.80 a pound. I can get it from a farmer at a farmer's market for about the same, or I can get regular broccoli for about $1.80 a pound. How will this local food movement help the consumer, and which consumers are going to be able to afford that, and do you think that'll change over time?
That's a really good set of tough questions, I think. First of all, I think the insight of the study that really I think is most often overlooked in our policy discussions of low-income people is that the food system itself is creating poverty by taking wealth out of the region. Farmers are shipping a lot of food away from the region by buying inputs from far away. Consumers are shipping billions of dollars out by buying food from far away, and that's just having the impact of taking wealth out of the region. That's actually creating some of the low-income people we noticed. And You're right. The 28% of the people live below the federal poverty level at which children qualify for free or reduced lunch at school. I think it's a real challenge to say you're in farm country and that you have children who are growing up next to farms wondering how to pay for food. That's really sort of a very awkward reality that we have to struggle with very mightily. And I think the price structure you talked about is really crucial. I know some places where farmers are raising food organically for their neighbors and selling it at conventional prices because they think people should have healthy food. That's happening in North Dakota with some farm communities I know. There are some low-income people who are buying organic milk. Maybe they choose one or two products they think are really the most important for their children, so they buy organic milk because they want the kids to have really high-quality milk and get the best nutritional start possible with that one item they think they can afford. Often people pay a little bit more for food and use it a little bit more sparingly. But ultimately, this is why the clusters of businesses are so important, that if we can't build those businesses to trade with each other, to give food to local people, to create livelihoods for local people, to meet local needs, it's very hard to ramp ourselves out of poverty. It's a very pervasive issue, and our food system generally is helping create that problem.
We have a caller on that we're going to take in just a moment, but I need to get to this short break, and we want to come back to the economics of these regional food hubs, both for the farmers as well as the consumers. We're going to take a short break. We'll have more of your phone calls, and I'll get to this caller from Clark County in a moment. We are talking with Dave Bishop, organic farmer of Illinois, and Tara Brockman has arrived from the Land Connection and Edible Economy Project, and Kenneth Meter. We'll be back in just a minute on Focus.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday features a tasting for support of the CU Schools Foundation, followed from 7 to 9 by the music of David Howie.
We're back here in Focus. We are talking about building regional hubs of food to help the economy and also to bring to eat food that's grown right here in Illinois. We have a caller from Clark County. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you for taking my call, and I'm glad to hear this programming. I'm wondering about leveling the playing field from the federal government perspective. Senator Durbin mentioned recently that 62% of the crop insurance is paid by the federal taxpayers for the farmers, the industrial farmers. And there was a guy, a market analyst of some sort, before you began your program today, who was complaining about the possibility of the government coming in during a drought and affecting the market, as he put it. But he didn't talk about the all of the subsidies, including the crop insurance that's being paid for by federal taxpayers. And I'd like to hear what you and your guests think about that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Dave Bishop, you're a farmer, 300 acres in Atlanta. Do you want to talk about how the government helps farmers in Illinois and the subsidies and how that works?
Well, as subsidies go, if you're going to pick one, crop insurance is probably one of the better uses of public funds, just in order to keep a lot of people from going out of business because of one bad year. Certainly, it would be preferable to just simply making direct payments. Personally, I think that that one of the issues with crop insurance is that it's restricted to certain crops, and it really needs to be available to all producers of all crops, including local food producers and local vegetable producers. We do pay a pretty hefty premium for this, so it's not a free gift by any means. Are you opposed, sir, to crop insurance, or give me a sense of what your feeling is on that?
I think he has left, but let me ask, okay. for listeners who don't know how crop insurance works, can you tell us just briefly how that works?
Yes, you sign up for crop insurance at some specific level, usually about 75% to 85% of production, and then circumstances beyond your control, such as the drought this year, you have protection against catastrophic loss of income. And typically, before crop insurance, as it was before the government got involved, was simply hail insurance. And, of course, that was fine if hail was the cause of the problem, but in a year like this, you need to have a more comprehensive system. So I think, in a nutshell, as subsidies go, this is probably one of the better uses of public funds for subsidies.
All right, Tara Brockman has joined us. Tara, you're from the Land Connection, the founder of that organization. You also are on the Edible Economy Project, and you grew up on an Illinois farm family. Tell us what the Edible Economy Project is. It's located in Bloomington. What's it about?
The Edible Economy Project began about 2 years ago, and a lot of us had been thinking about this issue for a long time, actually, the issue being the lack of infrastructure for local food production. So if somebody was growing fruits and vegetables or meats and eggs on a smaller scale for their local community, it was often very difficult. The farmer has to do everything. You know, you're planting the crops, weeding the crops, mulching the crops, growing them, bringing them to market, driving your trucks here and there, all around. If you wanted to process, you did your own processing. You had to build your own, you know, inspected kitchen with stainless steel, which is often beyond most people's time and money abilities. And so there was actually a kind of a seminal moment in Bloomington Normal when one of our farmers who had been growing beautiful, beautiful crops, and particularly carrots, found that his he had more carrots than he could sell locally. He wanted to get them to a school. The school really wanted the carrots, but they needed them peeled and sliced, and, you know, in small chunks for the kids. And he shopped around, finally found somewhere way up, like 8 or 9 hours from here in Upper Michigan, that he could actually get his carrots processed and brought back, which was cost prohibitive. So we had farmer A, and 5 miles away we had school B, but we couldn't get from A to B because we didn't have local food processing. And that was the moment where we said, we have to do something about this. And it's been now a broad-based community initiative. It's profits, nonprofits, governmental, schools, Heartland Community College has jumped on big time. And we've just been going on this kind of slow grassroots level to build the infrastructure we need so that more farmers can grow more product and bring it out to more people at a more reasonable price.
And I know Dave Bishop, who's here with us, is one of those farmers. Who else is involved in that? Group? What other farmers are involved in that?
We've been looking at some specific farms in the sort of 32-county region that Ken Meter's study looked at. So it's kind of from Champaign-Urbana through Bloomington-Normal through Peoria-Galesburg area. And we've identified farms that are already doing some ad hoc aggregation. One of them is Kilgus Farm, which is a milk producer in near Fairbury, Illinois. Another one is Living Waters Farm that is near Strawn, Illinois. They produce a lot of greens and tomatoes year-round in a hydroponic greenhouse with geothermal. It's a very cool place. It's huge. And so they were already there, and they and a few other people, some along 55, some along 57, were already sort of in an ad hoc way aggregating product from other local farms and getting it to restaurants in Chicago or to places in Bloomington Normal or Champaign-Urbana. And so we're using those as our sites for minimal on-farm hubs. And we did just receive a USDA grant. It's official now.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So we did get from USDA Rural Development through Heartland Community College and for work on the Edible Economy Projects, what we're calling minimal on-farm hubs as a first stage. So those are just a few of the farms that are going to be participating, but each of those farms will gather local food from maybe 5 or 6 farms near them and bring that together and then be able to transport that more efficiently.
Great. And I want to invite you to participate in the conversation, listeners, by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We just heard from Tara Brockman of the Land Connection and the Edible Economy Project. Ken Meter's on the line. He did the study, and we have a farmer as well. But I also have an email comment that came in that I want to read from Terry from the Quad Cities. Terry says, we could buy canned and frozen items in the winter that we knew were raised locally and organically. They would do that. And they wanted to know, do you think this continuity can be achieved anytime soon? And it goes on to say, having grown up on DeWitt County Farm in the 40s, I have an appreciation for what Mr. Bishop is attempting to do. So what about that? Being able to have these locally grown vegetables year-round, how will that work?
That's a great comment. And I live near Eureka. I grew up near Eureka. I went to Eureka High School. Eureka used to have a processing plant, and all the local farmers grew peas, you know, regular shell peas in the spring that went to the cannery. They grew sweet corn in the summer that went to the cannery. They grew pumpkins in the fall that went to the cannery. And all of that local food was, you know, grown on local farms. It was a nice rotation. It was a diverse farming system. Got brought to, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles to a local facility and was canned. And then that was local and further afield. It could get distributed. And that went from about, let me see, what did the guy tell me? From, I forget if it was the 30s or the 40s, through the mid-1960s when it shut down because there was some sort of consolidation and got bought out by Libby's or somebody, I can't remember. So it happened. It was there. We've almost forgotten that this was out there in our small communities, and there's no reason it can't come back. We do have the ability, and with the food hub idea, the food hub can be very small to start with as an aggregation point, but it can expand to encompass things like canning, freezing, drying, or just cold storage. You know, root crops, we can easily have beets, carrots year-round because, you know, with the right temperature and humidity, those things can last very well. And I think this is definitely possible. The main barrier is probably funding, but we're working on that.
And Dave, the vegetables that you grow on your land right now and the livestock, how do you sell it to people in Illinois? What's the method you use right now?
We use several methods. We have two farmers markets that we attend. We have a CSA. We have a series, a number of restaurants and grocery stores in the central Illinois area that we market to. So this enables us to, I guess you would say, engage in a limited way. We can serve these smaller groups of people. But the problem really comes in when you try to scale up and appeal to a broader range of buyers, particularly institutional buyers. And that's what the Edible Economy Project is really trying to do, is to allow us to move away from this inherently limited system that we have right now of distributing and selling food.
And a CSA, just for listeners who don't know, is Community Supported Agriculture. That's where someone would buy a share directly with you, and they get so much produce every week.
That's correct.
Okay. Ken, do you have any examples? We just got the news that, you know, Bloomington Normal and the Edible Economy Project with Heartland Community College is going to be able to use this USDA grant to set up this small food hub. Ken, do you have other examples in the country where this is already happening and is successful?
This has been happening all over the United States, and the USDA has a website called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food that now is starting to put up a map of the United States with all the food hub efforts that they have found. And my guess is that they have found most of them, but not all of them. I think it's really quite amazing how rapidly this has taken hold. But here in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I live, we've had a food hub, an aggregation center for local produce for about 35 years. We have actually had two businesses, one lasted the first 20, and another one has come in the last 15 or so. And what that's meant is that farmers who had a product to sell, who had a really high-quality organic food or sustainable food from diversified farms, could pretty easily find a market if their market was existing, because we had a distributor that could bring that food from the farm to other stores in the area. There really are an example of what the Edible Economy Project's doing is in Northeast Iowa, where a group of farmers called Grown Locally just started putting up a processing center on some acreage of a local farmer. And they put up a very simple shed with a heated floor, and they bought some used equipment that they could slice vegetables with, and they could peel carrots, and they could cut them into small chunks and put them in plastic bags and sell them to the local school. So I think this idea of starting with a very local initiative that's based on a farm and letting that take its course and letting it grow in an organic way is by far the most effective way to move this forward.
We have a caller from Urbana on line one. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm with the University of Illinois, and I am very interested in this call. I'm with the College of ACES. I'm calling to just reinforce some of the comment about the importance of some government support in local food systems. I work in the Department of Crop Sciences, and I know that a number of people around the country have received specialty crop research initiative funding. The University of Illinois has, in its extension program, devoted a fair bit of resource to local food systems, small farms educators around the state. There are 13 of those not all the counties are served, but a number are. And just like Tara mentioned, for the land connection receiving some federal support, hers by way of rural development, we recently received a grant for a beginning farmer rancher training program, with the idea that it's focused very much on fruit and vegetable production and trying to bring new farmers into the system. And we'll do that work at here at Urbana, but also at our research stations in southern Illinois at Dixon Springs and at the St. Charles station west of Chicago. In addition, there's a farm-to-school coordinator now in University of Illinois Extension. I think all of these are really obvious signs that there is interest statewide, university-wide, and at the federal government to support efforts to increase the viability of local food systems.
Great.
So just a comment.
I appreciate that that extra context. Thank you. Tara, I think one of the reasons that you got this grant and Heartland got this grant from the USDA was that you must have had people that said, oh, we're going to take this food. Not just are you going to provide a way for the farmer to not have to do it all, as you mentioned, grow it, process it, market it, sell it, transport it, right? But you had to have people in the region saying, I will buy this food. Tell us who has committed to buying this local produce that is going to be increasingly grown in Illinois as a result of this effort.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's not one of these things where it's like push, push, push. It's actually we're being pulled, and we're being pulled. That demand is there, and it's from the consumers, but it's especially from the institutions, as Dave mentioned. And those institutions include Illinois State University, Illinois Wesleyan University, State Farm, Caterpillar over in Peoria. Now, they haven't like committed because we're not there yet in terms of our production or the number of farmers and the tonnage of product. So we haven't reached the point of like having a contract or having a commitment, but we certainly have had interest. And, you know, and State Farm comes to us and says, you know, can we have cherry tomatoes in our cafeteria? And we, you know, we sigh and we say, yes, but not right now. You know, we don't have the farmers together. We don't have the infrastructure together to aggregate and then get those out to you, 500 pounds of cherry tomatoes a week or whatever it is that you need. We just don't have that capability because right now it's farmers like Dave, many other farmers I know in this area are limited to the farmers markets and CSAs practically and maybe a few other outlets because we don't have that facility. But those buyers are out there, and it's partially being driven by the Illinois Food, Farms, and Jobs Act, which mm-hmm. passed a few years ago in our legislature, which has a target of 20% of all state institutions will be buying locally Illinois-produced food by 2020, so 20% by the year 2020. And that's an aggressive goal. I mean, 2020 is coming up, and so we need more farmers, we need more land in local food production, but we really need that food hub, that sort of centralized facility that can gather it together and get it back out to institutions.
Well, we have calls coming in, so I want to get to those. Caller from Belgium on line 4, go ahead, please. Are you there from Belgium?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Well, not my question so much as my observation. I'm located just maybe 3 blocks from a wholesaler that supplies all kinds of vegetables and stuff for all over this east central area of Illinois. And here you're going to an effort to generate your own hubs, but why not get into those hubs that are already there?
Great question. Can you address that, Tara?
We are actually getting in contact with some of the existing places. I'm not sure exactly what hub is near you, but
The one is Vermilion Valley Produce.
Okay, thanks. We've been in contact with, I believe it's Central Illinois Produce. I can't remember if that's the actual name, but it often the problem is that these produce distributors already have very wide global, national and global pipelines that they get, you know, their garlic from China. And they get the garlic from China a lot cheaper than the garlic from Illinois. And so they don't particularly, some of them don't particularly want to change the way they're doing business because it is very cost sensitive or cost driven. We're a little more values driven. We appreciate cost sensitivity, no doubt about it, but we also know that there's consumers out there who want the values associated with the local food, meaning you're supporting your own community, you're keeping money within your community, you have transparency about who grew it, how it was grown, which you don't have when you're getting produce from China or Chile or any number of other places. So I think Dave Bishop also has a comment on that, but I'll say we are reaching out to people. We're not eliminating that possibility.
Right, and there's also not all of these companies like you, you're referring to there have the ability to clean, package, and you know some of these services aren't offered by a food distributor. So an aggregation center does more than just simply take boxes of already prepared food and rearrange them and ship them. If we're going to scale up this process and we approach a farmer and say, would you grow us 80 acres of potatoes? There's a lot of farmers in Illinois that can do that, but there's nowhere to take 80 acres of potatoes. So somewhere there has to be a facility that can receive a truck, a semi-load of these potatoes right from the field, wash them, sort them, grade them, package them, put them in a form that the consumer wants. Those services really aren't always offered by your typical distributor. So it's a different situation.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We have another call on line one from Kankakee. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to comment and bring to light a phenomenon that's happening in a place called in the UK called Todmorden, a town, Todmorden, and I sent you by email a link to what I'm talking about. But basically, a group of local people just decided to start growing food everywhere in front of the police station, and at the train station, and empty lots, and any open land that they could find. And they plan to be food independent by 2018. And I think that, you know, you're doing a lot of talk about systems and systems of food and basically kind of switching to local food but with the system paradigm. And I think that unless we engage in talking about, the financing and making local financing part of it, and also, you know, you have to take a look at sociology. I actually think that the extension could be a good resource for expanding on all of those areas instead of, you know, the cutbacks that have occurred in extension. I know that they're trying to engage with local food, but I just think that we actually need to increase their involvement and I think that if we don't look at the finance part of it, then it's difficult to make the system work.
Dave, what would you like to say about the financing part?
There's a book out called Slow Money by a guy named Woody Tesh, I believe. And the idea there is to really create a situation where investors can invest in this kind of thing. So there is interest and there is a need for investment money, certainly. And I think it's also a matter of finding the right system to accomplish that. But certainly we need to have investors. We need to encourage investments in local food systems.
And we are working with local banks. There's also a very interesting group that started recently. The acronym is SLOFIG, but it's S-L-O-F-I-G. It's Sustainable Local Food Investment Group. And it's a group of people who are specifically looking for projects where they can put their private money, and it is an investment. It's not a giveaway. So they're looking at business plans, and they're trying to say, you know, but it's a slow money. You know, it's slow meaning you don't need 25% return, and you don't need it in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years. Maybe you're looking at a very much longer time frame because, it's values-driven in addition to, I mean, they're not going to just throw their money at a project that's not going to make money. But they do want to specifically put their money into local food, and we're working with them as well.
Excellent.
Thank you for the call. I want to encourage you to call in. There's still a few moments left. We've got about 5 or 6 moments in the minutes left in the program. The number to call is 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We are guests in the studio, Tara Brockman from the Land Connection and the Edible Economy Project, Dave Bishop, a farmer in in Atlanta with Prairie Farms, and Ken Meter, who studied the economic situation in 32 counties in Illinois. We just have a few minutes left, so please give us a call if you'd like to chime in here. So what would you say is the I want to go to the food safety issue, too, because that's a big thing for people. How is this local food? Is it regulated the same way? Is it less or more safe? What would you say about that? When we have foodborne illness, E. coli, salmonella, we hear about it in the news. When you think about building these regional food hubs, where does that piece fit in?
It's an important piece, and we're certainly not going to ever say that our food is not susceptible to, having a problem. There could someday be a problem. I will say that when you look at sort of risk-benefit associated with local food or mass-produced food, the problem with a massively centralized food system is that when you have a problem, that problem can go to many states and many people can get sick, and it takes a long time to trace back and figure it out. And we've seen that over these years with what they thought was tomatoes, and then it was jalapenos or the spinach or whatever. And I would say that even though we have a possibility that there could be a foodborne illness, I talked to Illinois Department of Public Health and asked them, was there ever a foodborne illness associated with farmers markets? And their first answer was no, but their second answer after they researched it was yes. Once in 1992, there was some apple cider that had a little problem. So I would say that we have to be careful. We have to have food safety protocols, no doubt about it. But that when you do buy food from a local person, if there should be a problem, it's so traceable and it's so limited in scope that I think if you're talking about national security or something like that, you know, we would be much better off having lots of small producers locally than having one massive producer, you know, nationally, or a few massive producers like we do now with eggs, for example, and our egg problem a year or so ago. You know, that was eggs with, I think, 14 different labels, 43 different states, and lots of people got sick. And, you know, if you bought your egg from Dave Bishop at Atlanta, you'd probably be okay, you know, 99.9%. But if there was a problem, it would be so limited, and, you'd just be better off. So
we have three calls in the queue. I don't know if we'll get to all of them. Let me go to call one. Line one in Urbana. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I have a friend in the Homer area who is a farmer. They would like to use their own wheat and oats, but there's no place to grind them, and they don't know how to get the husks off of the oats and so forth. And I wondered if that has been thrown into the mix.
Good point. That's a little bit further down on our list. I know exactly what you're talking about. There's an organic wheat farmer near La Salle, Peru, Breslin Farms. They were trying to get their wheat processed. To put their own mill in was expensive. There's actually a restaurant in Chicago that put in a mill so they could grind this person's grain and make their pizza and pasta from it up in Chicago. So that's another infrastructure issue that is on the list, a little further down, but not too far on the back burner. I appreciate you bringing it up because we can grow fabulous wheat and other grain crops to grind.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to line four in Champaign. Go ahead, please.
We have a small family farm, and we have like 6 acres that is in filter strip or set aside. I just wondered if you've looked at those areas maybe where you could encourage where a farmer would still get the benefit of, you know, some profit, but maybe somebody else would come in an organic farm.
Dave, go ahead.
Yes, when does the contract expire on the conservation practice?
They come through every so many years, but is there a movement towards using that land for some of your purposes?
Well, there certainly is a lot of opportunity there, and if you happen to have some of that land or access to it, land coming out of a 10 or 15 year conservation practice is pretty good quality land. It obviously hasn't been sprayed or had a lot of chemicals applied to it, and so it very well could be prime real estate for a local food producer. Either you or if you have such a piece of land and you're looking for somebody to farm it, I'm sure the Land Connection folks would be really happy to try to put you together with a farmer. So that, yes, those things represent real opportunity.
So, to be utilitarian, if let's just say you were making $1,000 off of that land, is there any way you could break even if you turned it over to an organic farmer, for example?
Well, that's something you just simply have to work out with the individual involved. It's really difficult to say, you know, in a hypothetical situation what would work. But, just talk to somebody and see what you can work out.
It depends on what they're growing. They could easily make more money than that with intensive fruits or vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, very good. I guess that, you know, if the federal government encouraged it, maybe it would take some of the risk out for the farmer if he knew he could get the same amount but turn it over to you folks for someone to, you know, take a lot of its low land where it could flood and a 100-year flood or something. So anyway, something to work with the legislature maybe to see if that could be a win-win, farmer and farmer.
That's worth looking into. Thank you.
Great, and thank you for the call. Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the calls today. We are going to have to close right now, but I want to thank Dave Bishop of Prairie Earth Farm in Atlanta, Illinois, for joining us in the studio. Tara Brockman, founder and executive director of the Land Connection in Blooming, Illinois, also in the studio. And also by phone, Kenneth Meter, a food system analyst and president of Crossroads Resource Center in Minneapolis. Thank you all three for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.